From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Dr. Anthony Fauci testified by video link this morning before a Senate committee that is looking into the safety of putting Americans back to work. Dr. Fauci, as you probably know, is a prominent member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. He and a few other health leaders are in self-quarantine right now after being exposed to another White House staff member who tested positive for COVID-19. As expected, Dr. Fauci had a warning today about the reopening of the United States.
The consequences could be really serious, particularly, and this is something that I think we also should pay attention to, that states, even if they're doing it at an appropriate pace, which many of them are and will, namely a pace that's commensurate with the dynamics of the outbreak, that they have in place already the capability that when there will be cases, there is no doubt, even under the best of circumstances, when you pull back on mitigation, you will see some cases appear. It's the ability and the capability of responding to those cases with good identification, isolation, and contact tracing will determine whether you can continue to go forward as you try to reopen America.
That's Dr. Fauci this morning. You will hear more at noon today in a live press briefing by Governor Gavin Newsom. He is expected to announce guidelines for the continued reopening in California. Meanwhile, I also want to highlight some of Dr. Fauci's testimony about COVID-19. He was talking about vaccine development, so here he is again.
We have many candidates and hope to have multiple winners. In other words, it's multiple shots on goal. This will be important because this will be good for global availability if we have more than one successful candidate. We also, as the chairman mentioned, will be producing vaccine at risk, which means we'll be investigating considerable resources in developing doses even before we know any given candidate or candidate's work. I must warn that there's also the possibility of negative consequences where certain vaccines can actually enhance the negative effect of the infection. The big unknown is efficacy. Will it be present or absent, and how durable will it be?
To many people, a vaccine is the key to restoring the globalness of our world. We've been told, often by the president, that the process is being fast-tracked and there could be a vaccine in 18 months to 2 years. Yesterday, though, in a conversation with UC Davis veterinary scientist Dr. Niels Petersen, we heard another perspective. Dr. Petersen is an emeritus professor, a longtime researcher. He's worked on the development of a vaccine for HIV, something that still hasn't happened. Dr. Petersen has researched coronaviruses in animals, and he and his team discovered that a remdesivir-related molecule cures a deadly coronavirus disease in cats. So I asked him yesterday on Insight what he thinks the timetable for a COVID-19 vaccine might be.
Well, I'm a little bit more pessimistic. Definitely, it's going to be years. It's not going to be 1 year. It probably won't be 2 years. My guess is that it'll be more than 2 years before a vaccine is universally available and applicable, if it's possible. I mean, there is a possibility that the vaccines will not work very well, and there is a outside chance that this disease will, or this virus will, adapt itself enough to humans that it will become another one of those common cold-like coronavirus infections that we see in wintertime, and just be another one that's added to the list that, of the four coronavirus infections that already exist. So by the time a vaccine is developed, there may or may not be a great need for it. So it's going to be an interesting time. It's going to be an interesting period, and it could go a lot of different directions.
Again, that was yesterday on Insight, Dr. Niels Petersen, a UC Davis veterinary scientist. So let's explore this a little bit further with Dr. Amish Adalja. He is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and a member of the Infectious Diseases Society of America's Diagnostics Committee. Dr. Adalja, thanks so much for joining us on Insight.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I think you just heard the comments from both Dr. Fauci and Dr. Petersen. What's your perspective on vaccine development for COVID-19?
Vaccines are something that we usually measure the development time in years, not months. And we've been hearing about 12 to 18 months a lot during this pandemic. And I think that's overly optimistic. I think it is in the realm of possibility if everything were to go perfect. However, it's not something that we should count on. And I think it's clear that this vaccine is going to be an unprecedented effort to try and meet those deadlines. But we have to be prepared to fight this virus without a vaccine for a period of up to 2 years. And remember, even when we do get vaccine, it's not going to be 7 billion doses for the entire world. It will likely come out in tiers for healthcare providers, vulnerable populations, before the general population has access to it.
I want to get back to the doses for the entire world a little bit later, but meanwhile, where did the 12 to 18 months timetable come from, and why did it get so much energy and optimism around it, in that it sort of seemed to be an urban truth?
What I think lies behind that timeline is the fact that in the early days of the pandemic, we thought about what would be the most quickest way that you could think about doing this. And I think a year to 18 months is kind of a back of the envelope type of calculation, thinking about how much could we decrease the time to get to a vaccine candidate? Could we run phase one and phase two clinical trials together? How many people would we need to have in those trials to get some idea of how efficacious the vaccine was and how safe it was? So that's where that kind of came from. But it's really a function of the fact that we are using some new technologies that get it down quicker than in the past. But again, I think it's something that's on the very optimistic side of the spectrum, and something that we would aim for, but not necessarily want to have people rely upon.
So I heard you say time and technology, sort of these absolutes that can be moved around on the calendar or with the use of actual scientific machines. But in terms of developing the right compound, finding the right molecule, the right viral inhibitor, that part of the science, which is a little different, tell me about that track.
Well, at the same time that we're trying to find a novel vaccine, we are also trying to find treatments. And treatments are a little bit easier. And we've already seen in this pandemic the repurposing of other antivirals that were developed for other uses. So, for example, we've been hearing about remdesivir, and that's a drug that was initially developed for Ebola, which has now been repurposed for coronavirus, and we had a positive outcome in at least one trial. So that's a little bit different, trying to do that. And when we can expect to see treatments flourish after a period of time, and not just remdesivir, but convalescent plasma, we're hearing about taking the blood of survivors. We're also hearing about certain synthetic antibodies, which we call monoclonal antibodies, being developed to go against this virus. And there are a bunch of other drugs that are approved for autoimmune conditions, rheumatologic conditions, that may have some benefit in trying to dampen the immune response that happens in some of the severely ill patients. That happens on a quicker time scale, but again, none of those are really knockout punches or miracle drugs. We don't have the equivalent of a Tamiflu type of drug for this virus yet, although people are trying to develop.
That would be somewhat dependent, too, on antigen testing. So can I just turn you a little bit to that direction? And what about an antigen test, which Dr. Deborah Birx called a breakthrough, if and when it would happen, but it hasn't happened yet?
Antigen testing is something that's very simple. It's quick. It's easy. It can be done by an untrained person. It's not as cumbersome as the PCR test that you're seeing done. And this is something that everybody's had done. If you've ever had your throat swabbed and got a strep throat test, they're using a rapid antigen test. And it's something that would make it much easier to test people and be able to do on a wider scale all over the country in all different types of settings, including doctor's offices, urgent care centers, emergency departments. Even you could think about employers doing this for people they needed to test, or even sports teams doing it. So that's why this is being heralded as a really great breakthrough. We have to understand what its sensitivity is, meaning is it going to pick up all the cases? But that type of technology allows for testing to become much easier, much more widespread, and much cheaper, and maybe something that becomes part of the new normal as we move through the next phase of this pandemic.
But why don't we have an antigen test for COVID-19? What's the tricky part in being able to develop it?
Well, we actually do have an antigen test for COVID-19. There was one on Saturday that received FDA emergency use authorization. So we do have one. It was just a matter of time that we were going to get one, and it has been something that people have been waiting for, and it's a great development. And I think the news on Saturday was really greeted very well when that antigen test emergency use authorization was announced by the FDA.
So I want to back you up to when you were talking about remdesivir and the plasma, the convalescent plasma trials. You were talking about some of the other medications that might work as treatments. You didn't say hydroxychloroquine, but is that still on the table in some form as a possibility?
Right now, there are some randomized controlled trials going on with hydroxychloroquine. What we're waiting for is to see if it actually is effective. There has been some data that's come out, not from randomized controlled trials, but from more controlled studies, which haven't really shown any major benefit. So most of us in the field don't expect this to have a major benefit, or maybe only a marginal one at best. But it is something we're waiting for the definitive trials, but it's not something that I have a lot of hope will be an effective treatment for the coronavirus.
I'm talking with Dr. Amish Adalja. He is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. I probably should have done this in the beginning, but we jumped right into the conversation. Would you explain in a little more detail your work at Johns Hopkins and the dashboard of COVID-19 as it has moved around the world has become such a remarkable tool for people as we understand and track this disease, not to mention a lifeline or a conversation piece. But anyway, talk more about your specific work.
So I work at the Center for Health Security, which is a think tank that was founded in 1997, looking at the trajectory of infectious diseases, how they intersect with national security. Pandemic preparedness was initially founded in response to the threat of bioterrorism, and it was founded by D.A. Henderson, who was the man who eradicated smallpox from the planet. And this, our think tank really works on these issues at a very high level, at a policy level, as well as speaking to the general public and coming up with strategy documents, doing tabletop exercises, lots of different facets to how we prepare for pandemics, getting our hospitals ready. And I've been there basically since I was an infectious disease doctor in training and working on emerging infectious diseases, trying to predict what types of pathogens might cause pandemics, thinking about what the best economic policies are to develop countermeasures against some of these pandemics. That's basically the type of stuff I do. And I also see patients as well in both infectious disease and critical care settings as well.
Will you explain to me why you believe we are going to need to vaccinate the entire world against COVID-19?
Well, this is a virus that's established itself in the human population. It's what we say is endemic in the human population. It's not going anywhere. So in order to actually get containment of it, to be able to remove it from our threat list, we really have to have population-level immunity or herd immunity. And the way we're going to achieve that is through a vaccine. This is going to be something that people may get routinely, just like they get the measles vaccine, if everything goes successfully. And that's how we make this no longer a threat that we think about in the future. And it may, hopefully the vaccine actually has cross protection against other coronaviruses, and we get more of a universal response and really change the way we think about coronaviruses, which have been high on the threat list since the SARS epidemic in 2003.
What is the possibility, though, that we are not able to develop a COVID-19 vaccine?
I'm very optimistic that we'll be able to develop a COVID-19 vaccine. You have to remember, although we have no human coronavirus vaccines, there was a lot of work done on SARS vaccines that looked promising, and you have to remember that our veterinary colleagues do have vaccines against animal coronaviruses that infect cows and infect bird species, and those have been highly effective. So I think that gives us a good precedent that we can make a vaccine against the coronavirus. So I'm not really doubting whether or not one will ever come to fruition. It's just a timeline that we're worried about.
You just heard Dr. Niels Petersen, though, talking about the broader timeline that he's looking at. And his comments about COVID-19 are if, in fact, we are able to develop a vaccine. And he did find that this remdesivir molecule worked in cats. But he said perhaps this coronavirus will be like one of the others in humans, which sort of over time modifies, mutates out and becomes weaker. And it's one that we just end up living with. Is that a scenario that you see in the realm of possibilities?
I do think in the absence of a vaccine that this virus is not going to go anywhere, that it is going to become what will be the fifth seasonal coronavirus that we have. I don't know that it will necessarily modulate its severity. Viruses all mutate and they change some of their behavior, but it's not always the case that they're going to become less virulent. The virus is spreading pretty efficiently from person to person now, especially because people are more contagious when they have mild symptoms. So there's not really the virus really has no evolutionary disadvantage to stop being severe in those populations that they are severe in. And many viruses, respiratory viruses, can be mild for most people, just like this one is. And it's just those vulnerable populations that are still going to be impacted very severely with it. And I think that's more likely to be the case, that maybe this becomes something that is something we deal with all the time and we adjust our risk tolerance to it. But it's still going to be something that if you're in a vulnerable population, you have to worry about, just like those populations have to worry about many other respiratory viral infections like influenza or RSV or respiratory syncytial virus.
So let's talk more about that fact. And you said earlier the need for what you hope would be 7 billion doses of a vaccine, enough to take care of everyone in the world. There are populations that have become invisible in a way that are quite hidden right now and not attended to. And I think the concern is what will happen in these areas of the world. So tell me how much your eyes are on refugee populations or people and places where there isn't modern medical care and attention.
When you think about the developing world and these special populations like refugee and migrant populations, you always come to the fact that infectious diseases hit those areas disproportionately. We saw that, for example, during the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic. And there is a major concern about these populations being a place where the virus can really spread like wildfire and cause a lot of death and destruction. So we do need to have a plan for making sure that those individuals have the ability to be vaccinated and making sure that those populations are secure. Because so long as there are pockets like that are not vaccinated, the world will remain at risk, because this is a global world where people move around very, very quickly and will continue to move around very, very quickly. So it is important that we take care of this virus in all of its settings so that we are unable to be affected by it during our travels. And it's really important that the developed world recognize this and realize that the world has to be free of this virus for anybody to be really able to go about their lives the way they did prior to the emergence of this virus.
So we just have about 15 seconds left, Dr. Adalja. If you give me your final thoughts about what we should be focused on at this point in time in this pandemic.
This virus is not going to magically disappear. Social distancing was a tactic that we had to use in order to make sure that our hospitals didn't go into crisis. So now this virus is going to be with us. And the key question will be trying to control it and live with it in a way that doesn't put our hospitals back in crisis. So that means that vulnerable populations are still going to need to shelter in place. We need to move rapidly towards a vaccine. But this is something that everyone is going to have to deal with for the time being. And you have to think about what your individual risk preference and risk tolerance is as you move forward in your life in the era of this pandemic.
Thank you, Dr. Adalja. I appreciate your time on Insight.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Amish Adalja from the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. You've been listening to Insight on CAP Radio.